in so many places that I can't remember their names. And it takes me back home to all of the places where my memories will always remain.
That is the title track from Chris Hillman's 2017 solo album, produced by Tom Petty, called Biding My Time. Chris has had quite a career as a founding member of the Byrds, the Flying Burrito Brothers, the Desert Rose Band. He's also the author of a wonderful new memoir entitled Time Between. We are happy to welcome Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Chris Hillman to Downtown. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Where are you calling from? I'm always curious when people call to do interviews. What part of the country are you in?
We're in Bangor, Maine.
Oh, good Lord. Great. Love Maine. Absolutely love it. But anyway, so let's get down to it. I'm sorry, I go off on tangents, so bear with me today.
No, hey, I do that every day. That's how I make my living.
It's okay.
Well, yeah. Chris, I love the book. Time Between is such a wonderful book, and it's I found it positive and uplifting and inspirational, and it's about you and it's about the music. But I understand that you weren't sure you wanted to do this, and that it was reading Linda Ronstadt's memoir that really inspired you to go through with this?
Well, actually, Rich, that was a big part of it, but I have been working on the thing, well, almost 7 years. I had finished it, you know, a few years ago. I'd finished the book, and I said to my wife, we need to find an agent and see what's out there, if anybody's interested in publishing it. And so I meet Scott Bomar, who heads up the publishing wing of BMG, and had heard that I was doing a book and was interested. He asked if he could read some of it, and I sent him, you know, a couple of chapters, and he loved it and said, let's do it. We'd love to talk about publishing the book. And it was very nice and very flattering. He says, I don't think we need a co-writer on this. And I was very flattered to hear that, so that was really nice. But what it did was, once we had something in place as far as a real publishing deal, Rich, I got down to business and really started looking back at the book and re-editing it. And, of course, my wife was great. She helped out in a sense of she had not read a word of the book until we had this deal. And she starts reading it, and she says, you know, in chapter 5, you're talking about something in the session studio, and she says, why don't you embellish that and talk about the song you were cutting? I mean, just really good ideas she had. So I did, I added those things. I took some things out that I didn't think were relevant. And then Scott came up with the idea of opening the whole story with our fire, with this horrible fire that we almost lost our house in December of 2017. Let me get that right. There we go. And here's, it's like, it was 2 months right after Tom Petty had died. It was like a really tough couple of months for me. And but Scott had the idea, Rich, of opening the book and with that whole sequence of events where the fire takes over, and then we sort of backpedaling into it. Yeah.
And not the first time you had to deal with a devastating fire.
That wasn't. No. I have a great affinity for fire. I'm not sure where that's coming from, but gosh, when I was like 4 years old, 3 years old, I mean, our house started and caught on fire. And then when I was in the Byrds, I lost my house. And I'm still putting that mystery together. David Crosby was visiting me for about an hour before that fire broke out after he left. That's my next book, Rich, is the great Crosby fire mystery. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, so Linda, as I was in the process of now going through the book and, you know, just getting, polishing it up, and Linda, I had read her book, and I really liked it because she never denigrated anyone. She was only focused on the music, and that's exactly where I wanted to go with. I sent her a note. I said, I really loved your book. Between you and I, Rich, I don't really read those books that much, autobiographies, but I loved her book because she was just focused on the music and what she did, the career and how she pursued something she loved. And I said, I can relate to that. That's exactly where I'm going with this. And And I did tell Scott Bomar at BMG, I said, I'm not going to hand you a rock and roll Led Zeppelin meets, it's just not going to be there. I don't really have that interesting of a suspicious nature there. I didn't really go into some places I shouldn't have. So he said, I don't want that kind of book, which was nice. He said, I really don't want that. I just want you to tell your story. So, Rich, I wrote it like as if I was riding across country with you, and I said, here's what happened. 1963, I started playing blues, et cetera. So, like I was talking to one person, the way I wrote the book.
Well, and that's the way it reads, too. And I really enjoyed the early days, you growing up in Rancho Santa Fe and learning about a peanut brittle, your first horse that you rode, and then your dad bought your Ranger.
Yeah, he got, well, actually, I earned every dime for that horse, old Ranger, but he was great. That whole, I'll never forget when he, in the book where I said, my dad, we drive home, he says, go out in the corral. We didn't have any livestock then. He says, go out in the corral. I left some boxes out there, and I'm going, typical 10-year-old kid, oh, Dad. He says, just go out and get the boxes for me, and there was Ranger out there. I mean, wow, is that my, it was... I think Dwight Yoakam wrote such a beautiful foreword to the book, and where he connects the dots of my idyllic Leave It to Beaver childhood. And it was, Rich, it was the best, 1950s. And then he sort of connects the dots to the Los Angeles and then early 60s. Of course, he goes into and connects to references James Ellroy. Are you familiar with him as a writer?
Absolutely.
I am too. I love his stuff. And I thought that was really interesting. I mean, not that LA in the 60s was necessarily the LA that James Ellroy was writing about in the 50s, but there was a lot of that. When James Ellroy would always write about the LA Police Department, they were very corrupt. And up until the 60s, that's another story someone should write. they had to replace the chief that was in there. There was really bad stuff going on. Anyway, so that's it, yeah.
You end up forming the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers, and I thought it was interesting that a lot of guys came to rock and roll because Elvis inspired them, and it was rock and roll all along, and you certainly appreciated Elvis, and later you talk about seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, but you also had an interest in bluegrass and different types of music and the LA scene. People were playing those hoots at the Troubadours, Troubadour, correct. But you were more of an Ash Grove fan, as I understand.
I was, Rich. And it's funny, when Elvis came out, and I mean, Chuck Berry, that wonderful period of time, 1955, I'm going to put a earmark that year. And I loved that, as we all did my age. We loved that music. It got quiet about 1959, and it got real quiet on the radio, and we had Fabian and Frankie Avalon and this and that. And I gravitated into folk music because that was getting sort of popular on college campuses, and there, of course, my sister brings home some great records, and the Kingston Trio were on the charts with Tom Dooley. And it's funny, I liked the Kingston Trio back then for about 20 minutes, and then I got my head into some really more traditional mountain music, and by way of the mountain music and the string band music, New Lost City Ramblers and all that led me into bluegrass, which is a highly more polished form of string band music then. And I was probably one of two guys in my high school that loved that kind of music. It's very similar to how Herb Peterson grew up, who's the same age as I am, and he grew up in Berkeley, California, and he was in the same situation where he loved bluegrass. He's learning how to play the banjo, and maybe there's another guy in the high school that likes it or something,
But, was Bernie Ledden the other guy in your high school that liked that music?
Well, Bernie was Bernie's about 2 years behind me, and so I was out of high school, and I was in the Squirrel Barkers, and Bernie was going to high school in San Diego, and he was already at 16 an incredible banjo player and guitar player. And he played in the Squirrel Barkers briefly when a couple of the guys got drafted, and we had some shows contracted, and so Bernie sat in with us. Yeah, but then he moved to Florida. And this is another interesting side story, Rich. Bernie Ledden, one of 11 brothers and sisters. They moved to Florida, Gainesville, right after, about 1963. And he meets Tom Petty, who's also learning the guitar back there and living in Gainesville. And this connection, and then Bernie, Tom Petty, Bernie's brother, Tom Ledden.
Don Felder was there as well from the Eagles, right?
Don was the guitar teacher.
He taught Tom Petty.
He was teaching Tom how to play. He was teaching Bernie. And then Tommy Ledden was Bernie's brother, who ended up playing in a band with Tom. It's very interesting how these dots connect the dots. And then we all end up, and then, of course, I end up doing an album with Tom in January of 2017. Bernie and I are in close contact, always dear friend. And bluegrass is so interesting, especially if you sort of went from there into country music. And I would always reference it, Rich, as I'd say, I went to bluegrass school. You really learn the music. And it's funny because here I am, a middle-class California kid who surfed but loved bluegrass. And I end up working after the Squirrel Barkers in this band, the Golden State Boys, and then later called the Hillmen. And of course, in the book, I talk about Don Parmley, the banjo player from Kentucky, and Vernon Rex Gosden from Alabama. And they were like 10 years older than I was. But they were my, I always use this term, they were my window on authenticity, because here they are, the real guys from that part of the world. And I said, it's one thing. I think I told Herb, I said, we were lucky. Herb worked, you know, with a couple of guys called, Vernon Ray, and they were from Arkansas, older guys. But Herb and I both had the experience, opportunity to work with people that came from that part of the country. So what did we learn besides the music? We learned their culture, how they spoke, what they ate, how they thought. It was really interesting. It was at a whole other level, dimension to learning how to play this music, which was really not a part of the California scene, really, at that point. Here's the guys and back then that were playing bluegrass, David Lindley and Ry Cooder a little bit. Right. And just a few people in L.A. at the time, so...
We're talking with Chris Hillman here on Downtown. When I first started in radio 100 years ago, I was working at a country station, and Vern Gosden was making some great country records, and it was only later that I went back and discovered the work he had done with his brother and how great they were and how long they've been doing that kind of music.
Oh, Vern was fantastic and so well-deserved when he got all those accolades, and he had Chiseled in Stone, and he had all these great songs he wrote, great singer, and highly respected in the Nashville, in the music business, highly respected. And we remained very, very good friends all through the years until he passed away. And he was like a big brother, Rich, if you can imagine me with a phony ID, not the one I made, the one we were making. This fellow was talking to me the other day. He says, so your life of crime was really the fake IDs and stealing blue jeans at the makeup. And I said, yeah, that was about the extent of my criminal career. But Vern was my big brother, so we would be working these hillbilly clubs around L.A., out in the suburbs of L.A., and he was my big brother. He'd look after me. I was an 18-year-old skinny kid, you know, but a wonderful man. All these guys, they were all, I always felt as sort of a subtext, I think I implied that mentors in our lives, and people that sort of say, hey, why don't you try it this way or that, or they go this way, I always acknowledge that. I had so many people that were sort of guiding me along, and maybe I didn't realize it at the time, but later I did, and then I feel the book has, I appreciate you saying that, it is positive. I want it to be uplifting, and I wrote it that way, and about lifting yourself up through any adversity. When my dad was a really good man, he was not some abusive, drunken guy beating us up. He was a good, loving, affectionate, hardworking, creative man. And he just lost his way about 1961 and took his life. And it was so devastating for us, as anybody who experiences suicide, so devastating. And you feel abandoned. And I was angry, so angry for 10, 20, 30 years. And till I finally forgave him, and way too late in doing that, but whatever. But the subtext or of the book is just the redemption is picking yourself up. And when we found out after he died that we had no money, we didn't know that. And my older brother was out of the house, and my older sister was out of the house. And my mother sits my little sister and I down, and she says, "We're moving to Los Angeles." Now, normally, kids that age would say, "We're not moving. We can't leave our friends. We don't want to go to a city," and blah, blah, blah. No one said a word. Everybody said, "Okay, Mom." And everybody did what they had to do. And there wasn't any options, Rich. Mm. You know, we need to go move. She said, "I have a job." I went and got a job, as it says in the book. My sister went to school, high school. And we survived. And then when I turned 18, and the Squirrel Barkers were beckoning, oh, did I have a love of that music. And I sat her down. I said, "Mom, I want to go down to San Diego." And she says, "Okay." She said, I think you'll be okay. I'm not worried about you. You'll survive." She was fantastic. She didn't hang on to me and say, "Don't leave me. I need you here. You've got to," you know, and a very strong woman. And I owe her so much. She's gone now, but I do owe her for keeping us all together in the family and being such a strong, that old Texas stock she had. Actually, oh, yeah, and part of her family came from Newton, Massachusetts. My great-grandfather came from Newton, Mass, across the country by wagon, train, and even the last 100 miles on a horse. I mean, it's a true story. It's great. Great legend there.
Well, Chris, a big turning point in your life came when Jim Dixon said you ought to come listen to these guys. They were called the Jet Set, David Crosby, then Jim McGuinn, Gene Clark. And then they asked you a few weeks later, "Can you play bass?" And like any aspiring musician would say, even if you can't, you said, "Of course I can."
Yeah, well, after I heard them sing, Rich, I mean, they really sound good. I mean, you know, Crosby was an unbelievable singer back then, still is at 78 years old. He's still a great singer. And McGuinn and Gene, they sounded great. And they were just three guys and a couple of acoustic guitars. And after having worked with Vern and Rex Gosden, and I had very high standards for vocal harmonies because the Gosdens were fantastic. But when I heard those three guys sing, I told Jim Dixon, I said, this is good. This is going to, I hope this works out for everybody. And I went back to my job in the horrible group I was in, the Greengrass group. Yeah, it was a pretty bad one. But then 2 weeks later, he says, "Can you play the bass?" And then he proceeds to go on. He says, "David was going to be the bass player, but he doesn't want to, he doesn't feel comfortable." He says, "Can you play bass?" I said, "Sure, I can." I knew they were going to do something interesting, and I marched in there. I don't know where I found this bass I got. It was $50. Rich, I think I got it at a music store or a pawn shop, seriously. I had never even held an electric bass. I had goofed around on a stand-up bass, but I didn't know how to play the bass. It was the four strings of a guitar, so I mean, I said, okay, I can handle this. I go to that first rehearsal. I didn't even know these guys, and I am assuming, I think I laid it out in the book, but I'll be a little more focused here. I was assuming they had amps and drums in there and everything. I walk in, and there's one old amp in the corner, and Roger's plugged in, and Gene strumming on a guitar, and Mike Clark had the best rig going. He had the cardboard box, one snare drum, one cymbal. And I went, first I looked at them and I went, this is like a Lonnie Donegan skiffle band. You know, remember John Lennon was in a very similar, he was in a skiffle band before they started the Beatles, right? So it was very similar, it was like a jug band, folk band type deal. Anyway, we literally, I used to say this on stage, still use it, but we literally all plugged in. And we weren't a garage rock band, as you know, and we plugged in and we sort of created a sound. We were very much into the Beatles at first, and then Gene was already writing a bunch of great songs, and Roger was writing some good ones, and just the sound developed. But Roger was really most instrumental, no pun intended, in pulling the band together, because he was had had the most experience as a musician out there.
Now, I was surprised to read that Jim Dixon was not a big fan of you guys recording Turn, Turn, Turn.
Oh, isn't that funny? Yeah, he said, I'll never forget. He said, this might be the last number one single you have. And I said, well, is this on philosophical grounds or what do you... He said, well, it's just too black and white. Well, I didn't know anything then. Good Lord. I said, well, isn't that the way the scripture reads? It's sort of like you're born, you die, you plant, you reap. It is sort of black and white. But anyway, there wasn't much of an argument. We just went ahead and cut the song. I think it's probably the signature Bird song over Tambourine Man. But, you know, it's a great track. I mean, and we played on it. Tambourine Man, we did not play on that one. And you can tell it's pretty slick. But Turn, Turn, Turn is where we really stepped up to the plate and laid down a great song.
Before I read your book, I was reading a book about Laurel Canyon and the music scene back in the 60s, and you were the first guy there among the musicians.
As far as I remember, but then someone says, was Frank Zappa up there? I believe he was. I knew Frank. I didn't go to his house or anything, but I think he lived a couple streets over. And there were some, you know, a lot of, in the early days, there were actors and jazz musicians that lived up in the canyon because it was really about 5 minutes from the Sunset Strip. So you just went right up from the Sunset Strip up over the hill and you're in Laurel Canyon. So it was quite an interesting change of scenery because it was very, in a sense, sort of rural. You know, it's wonderful up there, wonderful old houses and things, yeah.
The band went through some changes in 67. Jim Dixon out, David Crosby out, Jim McGuinn became Roger McGuinn, and you welcome in the talented but certainly troubled Graham Parsons. How did that change the dynamic of the Birds?
I think Roger had said at one point, right around that time, we were doing the notorious Bird Brothers album, and all of a sudden, it was just the two of us. Right? I mean, Mike left. We had to let David go. It wasn't working out. And then Michael decided to quit a month or two later. But it was fine. We finished that out. It was one of our better records. And we used some really good players on there. We used Clarence White, of course, who became in the Birds later. We hired him later. But we had Jim Gordon playing drums, who had, of course, went on and played with Derek and the Dominoes and played with Souther Hillman Furay. And then we know what happened to him, poor man. Anyway, so we finished that album, and the whole thing about Graham, and I meet him, and, you know, and he was totally, he was ambitious, focused. He was hungry. He wanted to, not literally hungry, but he wanted to make his mark, and we hired him. And I didn't know he had such an affinity for country music, and when I realized that at the first rehearsal, I said, I've got an ally. And it was shortly thereafter that we started to think about doing a country album. And it was never, Rich, it was never like, we're going to make a country album and we're going to cross over and be a different type of music. It was just the Birds doing a country album and still being the Birds, you know, and that's what happened.
Well, Sweetheart of the Rodeo was not a huge hit at the time. Now, all those years later, people look back at it as one of the seminal albums of the 1960s, but I read that you and Roger initially weren't even comfortable with that label of country rock.
Not really, because we'd already survived the label folk rock. We survived folk rock in this order: raga rock, psychedelic rock, and country rock came along. And then all of a sudden, here we are, and it's all Americana. Now it sort of makes sense because it was really, it was just a matter of somebody labeling something they were writing about. A journalist is writing about something in 1967 and calls it this or that or country rock or this or that. But I'm sort of, it doesn't bother me at all. It's funny now, I go, country rock, whatever. To me, it's music, but I guess you have to be sort of definitive in, you know, in describing it. The funniest thing about the Birds is, for us to go to Nashville and do Sweetheart of the Rodeo, it was never a stretch because we were the guys coming out of folk music, me more so with the bluegrass. I had more credential in that sense, but it wasn't a big stretch for us to do that and to assume the mantle and go after the country stuff. And we had already, as you know, recorded a Porter Wagoner song on our second album, Satisfied Mind. And so we were doing that. We were messing around with it way back in 65. Anyway, yeah, and I mean, I never thought, I thought the Sweetheart album was good. It wasn't my favorite Birds album, and it didn't do great business. But it did, a few years later, it went really, just picked up speed, and people started really loving it. When we went out and did the 50th anniversary tour, we were doing sellout business, and it was great. Wonderful tour that was with Marty and Stuart and Roger. It was great.
We're talking with Chris Hillman on Downtown. Let's talk about the Flying Burrito Brothers, you and Graham, and a talented group of musicians that were almost instead called the Alabama Sheiks.
Good name if you're a blues band. I think that's a good name. But burritos were fun. And like I say, Graham, through the Sweetheart period, he was focused. And the first burrito album, when we were sharing a home together and writing every day, was great. He was very, very on his game. And it's like Sin City, the song, we did that, finished that off in 35 minutes, thereabouts, 35, 40 minutes. And the best part was that people covered our songs. They covered Sin City. Dwight Yoakam did, Katie Lang, Beck, Emmy Lou, of course, cut a lot of the burrito stuff, and Steve Earle. And it was great. That the ultimate stamp of approval if somebody records one of your songs. But the first year of the burritos, it was interesting. It was people say, "What's your band name?" I said, "Flying Burrito Brothers." And I'd get, sounds like a Mexican acrobat team. I said, yeah, we could do that if you want, whatever. Yeah.
You guys,
act.
You played Altamont, and we had Chip Monk on the show not too long ago.
Oh, God, I know him. Rich, is Chip? I thought he had passed away.
No, he's living in Australia now and going strong.
Oh, my God.
But he said that was the end of it all. Everything that had gone well at Woodstock came crashing to the ground at Altamont.
That's exactly right. And it was the end of the 60s, of the idyllic peace and love, and Altamont came along, and that was the day it died. That was the day the 60s died. Absolutely right. Well, it's good to know Chip's around. I don't know why I thought he had passed away. But, yeah, he was our road manager for one tour, I think.
Wow. You worked with Stephen Stills and Manassas, and I got the impression from the book that it was good to not be in charge and just concentrate on making good music.
Oh, yeah. I loved that band. And I had to get me on my toes. Those guys were really good players. And it was always interesting. The Burritos had an interesting history. I went from playing 8 Miles High with the Birds and So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. Those are really good smoking tracks. And the Burritos had songs, good songs, but we were so lazy in our execution. And then later, about a year later, and Graham is gone, and I put the band back together, the Burrito Brothers, and we had a really tight group. And the last album we did was called Last of the Red Hot Burritos, and it's a live album, very good record. But working with Steven, I really had to be on my toes. They were such good players. And Stills was an old friend from the Buffalo Springfield days. And he was, again, I'll use this phrase, he was at the top of his game. He was singing great. He was writing good stuff. I mean, the Manassas, the first record, was a double album, and it went into the top five. But it was, I loved it. I loved the music. I loved writing with Stills. I learned a lot, Rich. I learned little tricks about writing songs from him. And I learned a lot of guitar. I would just watch him. I'd go, And I'd see how he would approach something. And it was a great, great experience. And then it went as long as it could. It went 2 years. He goes back to CSN, And, you know, through the book, I always say I was always going to register for the next semester in college. And a door would open. And a door opened after Manassas. Souther Hillman Furé was presented to me as an idea.
And that was by David Geffen, right?
I'm sorry, yeah, David Geffen, yeah. And I knew Richie Furé very well. I didn't know J.D. at all. But, yeah, it was, I think, David Geffen's idea of, I'm going to make another Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And on paper, it looked great. It was a great idea and good choice of people. But we just didn't have the time to develop the band as we could have. But, gosh, you know, I keep running into people that swear by that first Souther Hillman Furé album, love it. And so I said, good, okay. It was a good album. You know, but
the best thing that came out of that that partnership, though, was reconnecting with Connie.
Yes, it was. Yes, indeed it was. the woman who stepped in and steered me right 41 years ago. Been married 41 years.
Wow.
More. I've been together a long time, a little longer than 41 years, been married 41 years. And all I've got, and what I've gotten out of that, of course, I've got two great kids that are grown and successful, and I have two grandkids from one child. And I mean, I wouldn't trade my family for any, I know this sounds very noble, but I mean it. I wouldn't trade what I have now for any hit record or fat bank account or fancy car. That doesn't mean anything. My family means a lot. That means a lot to me. And I think that's also implied in the book where I realize things and as I grow up and get more comfortable in my own skin. You know, I mean, you know, a long time I was such a shy guy in the birds and probably a little bit of a lack of confidence, and even up home to the burritos for a while, and then I started to reclaim all of that and learned how to sing better and all of the above. So yeah.
Well, you did that in a big way in the mid-80s when you got back together with Herb Peterson and John Jorgensen and the talented group that made up the Desert Rose Band, a dozen top 40 country hits, a couple of number ones. Yeah. But I was surprised, you know, as somebody who was playing those records at the time, surprised to read that with all the chart success you had because of record company politics at the time, the records didn't sell as many copies as one might have imagined.
You know, exactly. And, you know, the normal complaint from the artist is, and mind you, the normal complaint is our records aren't being pushed, they're not in the stores, da 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 da. But if you don't have success on the radio, and you know you were a radio, you're on the radio, what am I talking about? But if you don't have the chart success, it's kind of hard to market the product. We had the chart success, Rich. I'll never forget playing in New York City, and Herb Peterson and I walk across the street to Tower Records. And this is, we had a number one single. I think one of the songs was out, I Still Believe in You or something. And we go over to the Tower Records. There's not one Desert Rose album in there. I'm going, I don't understand this. And I could never get a straight answer out of them. And it was like just frustrating as all get out. Now, funny enough, as it happened with the Burrito Brothers, people are discovering the Desert Rose Band by hook or crook. I don't know how that's going on, but there's still some records in print. But it wasn't, we had a great band. I mean, our live performances were 90 percentile, in the 90th percentile, meaning everybody was a pro. There was no lingering issues or baggage or anything. Everybody got up there and they played well and they sang well, and we worked with some of the greatest people, the nicest people ever, Reba McEntire, Merle Haggard, the Oak Ridge Boys, who really got our career going and gave us a break and had us open for them in Las Vegas, and just being nice guys, wonderful people, and just the Judds, the people that we were working with back in the late 80s, so nice. And I'll never forget Reba McEntire, and we were the opening act, and she said, and she would keep her guys around, have them stay, so we got a sound check. When they were supposed to be eating dinner, that she'd have them stay, so we would have a sound check. And she told me, she said, I was an opening act, I remember. And you guys will always have a sound check if you work with me. I went, wow. but a nice person, and she was sweet as can be.
Now, you're very proud of the fact, and it's certainly unique, that when you were all inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the early 90s, you guys and the Byrds were the only band that actually sat together at the same table.
I think that record holds. We sat down together. We went up together. We played a couple of songs, and Paul Schaefer and the Letterman guy, the guys that played on Letterman, backed us. Roger and I played. Roger played 12, I played bass, and then we all sang. It was great. It was a wonderful evening. And the other thing, I was just reading about, I read an article about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how it was virtual this year. And they were making reference to how really special it was before they started televising. And it was. We were in the Waldorf Astoria ballroom, and we had the Rock and Roll ceremony in 1991. And at that particular night was when the first Gulf War started. So they stopped the ceremony, and President Bush, H.W. Bush, gets on there and starts talking about the Gulf War and Kuwait and all that. And then we resumed the event, but it was great. Loved it. It was quite an honor, I must say.
And you've stayed close with Roger and with David Crosby. And David talks about it in the terrific documentary about him, that he's burned a lot of bridges with old bandmates in his life. How have you been able to maintain that relationship?
Because I love the guy, Rich. There were times David Crosby, despite his rather interesting life and the mischief he manages to conjure up every other week, I love the guy. He was there for me in some very serious times. When I got sick, he was there helping me. I don't think I could work with him again, but I do love him very much. I care about him. I do care about him, and I love Roger. Care about him. There won't ever be a Byrds reunion, and just as well. I mean, two principal guys are gone. Mike and Gene have passed on, and at best we just enjoy our life at this point. You know,
well,
I talk to Roger every Friday. Roger and his wife live in Florida, and Connie and I, my wife and I, and a couple of other couples, we get on Skype every Friday and play Trivial Pursuits.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But we're very close to going to the country club, ending up in a country club playing bridge, which is sort of a stereotype if you think about it. You know, your parents, if they were in that kind of a economic area, that they could go do those kind of things. But anyway, so we play Trivial Pursuits. Then I catch up with Roger every Friday. Being 3 hours difference, like where you are, you know, so it's 1:30 in the afternoon in California. It's 3:30. What is it? 1:30? Oh, what is it? 4:30. It's 4:30 in Florida. And it's sort of funny because they're always having cocktails, and if they get one of the questions right, they each have a drink. And I said, I don't think I'm going to join you because it's 1:30 in the afternoon. So I'm going to have a drink of coffee. But it's fun. We have a lot of fun. It's almost silly fun.
Well, you mentioned your sickness, and what a harrowing time that was, a real brush with death in dealing with hepatitis.
Yeah, it was something. I came to grips with it at one point, and it was the treatment, although successful, damn near killed me. It really, my body was so toxic. It was like having chemotherapy every day. So, but I made it. You know, within 3 months, that virus was out of my body. But because it was such a new disease, this is in the 90s, and doctor was keeping me on this therapy, which was very toxic to the body. So, but I'm fine. I was 20 some odd years ago, 25 years ago.
We would be remiss to not mention your collaboration with Tom Petty on Biding My Time. It's such a good album. I love the title song.
Thank you, Rich.
Love your cover. We had Sonny Curtis on the show a few months back. Love your cover of Walk Right Back that's on there. What was it like working with Tom, and how very heartbreaking was it to lose him at such a young age?
that just fell in my lap, and so to speak. I mean, Herb was hired to be a backup singer with Tom when he went out. And he did a the Mud Crutch tour. Was the first band he was ever in.
Right.
It was, had Bernie's brother Tom in it. Tom led, and they hired Herb to do background vocals. And then they, while they're out on the road, as I wrote in the book, and start talking about an album, and Tom says, "Oh yeah," and, da, da, da. And so when Herb gets off the road, he says, "Call Tom up." Well, I knew Tom, Rich. I didn't know him that well. Roger was very, very, very good friends with him. But I said, okay, and I, you know, put it off. And I finally called him, and we talked it out. And it was funny. I said, "You sure you want to do this?" He says, do you want me to? And I said, "Well, do you want to?" And it was back and forth. I said, "Oh, man, I'd love to go in the studio with you." And off we went. We planned it, and we went down to his studio that he had in the San Fernando Valley here in L.A., and ended up overdubbing most of the other stuff at his house. He was a lovely, lovely guy. I got to know him so well. And I've never met a more humble man in my life that occupied the position he had. He was a worldwide rock star. I mean, serious. But the most humble guy in the world. There was just never that. You never looked at Tom Petty and thought, "Wow, this guy has an attitude," or "He's a big rock and roll guy, big ego." Nothing like that. Loves music. He loved it. I always loved the Heartbreakers because they would tackle anything. They'd cut anything they liked. If they heard a Bo Diddley song, they'd record it. I love that. Just total passion for the music. He had that. And when I was went to his house the first time, and he says, "Show me what a couple of the songs." I wasn't prepared. I was nervous. And I start playing, and he says, "Well, okay, is this going to be a folk album?" And he was serious. I said, "You know, I don't know, Tom." He says, "That's okay. We'll just make a great record. We'll call it whatever we want." And ends up where he really did want more drums at the end, after I find that out at the end of it. But he loved the record. I know that because so many people he knew he would show off and play the record from, which was wonderful. And just a joy. We got that record done so fast because we were having so much fun. And so off I go. And then we got it done about February of 2017. Is that right, Connie? 2017, yeah. And we got the record done. Yeah, the Bide My Time. And I went out and promoted it, and we end up in Nashville in October, and that's when I heard he had passed on the news. I couldn't believe it. And that was such a funny day, as you read in the book. And Crosby calls me out of the blue and says, "Hey, is that true about Petty?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "I don't know, David. I just heard this. I hope it isn't." And I'm going, man. And then finally I find out it is true. And I go, okay, we had four more shows to do. The last one ending up in Los Angeles. I said, I think we're going to cancel these. We're going to move these shows and go home. And I was very upset. And then I get the call from Roger out of the blue. And I told him, I said, "I'm going to go home. I'm going to cancel." He said, "Don't do that." He said, "Do not do that." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Tom would not like it if you were quitting, canceling shows. Go out and play and play in praise of him. Get up there and do a show honoring him." And I said, "You're right. You're absolutely right." So we didn't. We went out and played, and always was for Tom every night. It was great. So yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. And then we come home, and you know, December 4th. 2017, and having dinner, it's my birthday, and there's a fire that's broken out two towns away from where we lived, and my son-in-law is a fireman. He's sitting with us at the table, and he gets a text. He says, "It's nothing big, no big deal. It's too far away from your house." And then as we left the dinner and we go home, the wind had picked up, Rich. It was 70-mile-an-hour wind, and it was blowing, man. And we get home, and the power goes out. And I'm propping up the garage door, I think, with a broom handle just to get the car out. And we didn't realize. And then finally, we had gone to bed, and then Connie smells smoke, and we look out. She goes out. We look out the front door. The fire had moved 30 miles north, and the entire ridge was lit up. It would look like it was a firestorm. 70-mile-an-hour wind blowing this flames, and they're blowing embers, you know, and that's what caused these houses to burn. The embers get blown into a wooden roof or a shingle or something, and you're pretty much toast at that point, literally. Mm. But we evacuated. We didn't lose our house. As I said, we lost a kitchen and a family room. And we were out of the house for 8 months. It was just another thing, like when my dad died, where we had to pick up and go deal with it, which we did. There was no other options. You know, we weren't going to say, okay, we're done. The house burnt down. We're going to go to Mars. It's just, you know, you pick up and get things together. Thank God my wife is so wonderful, and she is so organized and everything. And we're back in the house. Things are good. We have wonderful grandkids and everything, and we'll see where it all goes with the book. I just wanted to get that book out. I was really originally writing that for my kids and my grandkids. My kids pretty much know my story, but it was just hard to leave behind for the grandkids, so whatever. But it's getting lots of attention, which is nice, and I love it when people tell me how much they love the book. That means a lot to me.
Well, it's been a remarkable life in music, but obviously, and we find this out in the book, the pillars of your life are your family, Connie, the kids, grandchildren, but also your faith. How important was it for you, and what's that done for your life to embrace that faith?
It's done nothing but wonderful, wonderful things. And I'll put it this way. I never could understand how a family could deal with the most egregious thing ever for anyone, especially a family, is when you lose a child. Without a Christian Judeo foundation to lean on, or anything horrible in your life or your family, without that to lean on, to seek solace in, it's been wonderful. And I was an evangelical Christian for a long time, and then I converted to the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, which I just love it. It is so beautiful, and just layers and layers of wisdom and tradition. And so, yes, it has changed my life for the good. But I still trip and fall and do stupid things like everybody else. I think the most beautiful thing about the Christian faith is the concept of forgiveness. And if we could all grasp hold of that, it'd be a nice world. And the hardest virtue is humility, is to get your hands around being a humble person. I don't know, that's just a part of human nature. We struggle with that, all of us. So yeah, I've embraced my love with Christ and all, but I'm not. I can safely say to you, I'm certainly not the completely wonderful guy in the world. I still make mistakes like everybody else, but I ask God to forgive me for my ignorance sometimes, as we all do. So, yeah,
well,
a great thing.
What comes through in the book is that you've had a remarkable professional life, but your personal life has been the key, and it's so great to read the book and hear the stories and to learn about the music, but also to see that here you are, after all these experiences, happy, fulfilled, still making music, and able to tell this wonderful story in your book, Time Between.
I'm very blessed, Rich. I'm a very blessed man, and I don't take anything for granted, and I appreciate it, everything that we have and everyone else has. And we all will get through all of this. I know that's a tired phrase, you know, this strange things in the country and all this, in the world, really. But we'll get through it all. It'll resolve itself.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a real delight. I really did love the book, and it's so good to have the opportunity to talk with you today.
I appreciate your call very much, Rich. It was nice talking to you. You're a good interviewer.
Well, thank you. Stay safe and be well.
You too, buddy.
So much fun. Chris Hillman, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. You name it. Birds, Flying Burrito Brothers, Desert Rose Band, Souther, Hillman Furay, and on and on and on. A really good guy. 531. His new book called Time Between. Available anywhere you buy good books these days.